Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Casablanca Conference in January 1943. Now, those of you who are studying GCSE or A-level history, probably looking at America, Britain, or the Cold War, will be aware that throughout the Second World War there were a series of conferences between the Allied powers to decide a number of things. Later conferences are really about deciding the shape of the post-war world. By 1943, the future course of the conflict was still very uncertain. There were a number of debates between particularly the Americans and the British as to how best to proceed against Nazi Germany. And of course the Soviet Union, who had been invaded by the Germans in 1941, were anxious for something to be done to alleviate their plight. So this podcast is really about discussing how the Casablanca Conference fits into all of that, and what happened at the conference, and how that really influences the outcome of the war. So, for example, if you've got an essay which looks at some of the wartime conferences, you might want to be drawing out ideas about significance and importance. And so this podcast is designed to help with that, really. The choice of venue for an Allied meeting of this magnitude was far from coincidental. Casablanca in Morocco in North Africa was an ideal spot. The fortunes of the Allied powers in Africa had changed at the end of 1942 and the beginning of 1943. The victory in the desert far to the east in Egypt over the Germans at El Alamein had been the first great breakthrough of the war by the British. Churchill said that they had never won before El Alamein, and after El Alamein, Britain never lost. It was a hugely significant moment as it prevented the Germans from reaching the Suez Canal and effectively cutting the British Empire in two, and then marching on to access the oil wells of the Middle East. So there was, in comparison to Stalingrad, it's a relatively small battle, but it was an enormously important one for the British to win, in no small part because of the British need to demonstrate to the public it had the capacity for victory. North Africa, of course, was another important strategic theatre for the Allies, as it was where the Americans first really see action in the European and Middle Eastern theatre. The Americans, along with the British, had landed in Morocco and Algeria after all manner of fraught negotiations with the Free and Vichy French forces in the area in the torch landings of November 1942, which were the first major amphibious landings by the Allies of the war, and would be followed, obviously, later on by landings in Italy, and then later on Normandy, where they had to some extent perfected the process. At this point, the Americans occupied a position which is, I guess, quite unusual, quite alien to people who have grown up looking at the war through war movies like Saving Private Ryan and that sort of thing. At this point in time, The Americans viewed themselves and were viewed by the British as well, who had a very superior attitude towards the American chiefs of staff, as the junior partners in the relationship. And this wasn't to last for very long at all. Churchill was well aware that in terms of manpower, material and equipment, it was he that was the junior power. He viewed himself as Roosevelt's lieutenant. The British chiefs of general staff believed that the Americans were less experienced in fighting, and the Americans looked upon the British as having been blooded by the war and knowing what was required in major battles against the Germans, and were, up until the Italian campaign, willing to bow to the senior experience of the British generals. But as I said, this deference was, from many, grudging, particularly in Washington from Admiral King, very grudging indeed. And it was based really on the fact that the Americans had yet to encounter in battle the Germans. And when they do, at the Kasserine Pass in Tunisia in February 1943, the results are catastrophic. Inexperienced American officers panic. They are completely outclassed by Rommel, and the defeat turns into a rout. Rommel believed that he was going to deliver a salutary lesson to the Americans in what they would face if they chose to carry on fighting the Wehrmacht. And the result of this really was to strengthen American resolve and to really inform the American command of the challenges of defeating the Germans. The Casablanca Conference would become a testing ground for the Anglo-American relationship. Already two different visions of the war were, and its future had developed in the minds of both the chiefs of general staff in either country and President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. Roosevelt, perhaps rashly, had already in 1942 strongly hinted to Stalin that a cross-channel invasion would be possible of France in 1943. The British thought this was hopelessly optimistic and that the Allied powers wouldn't be ready to at least 1944 to engage in such an act. Stalin, who was fighting the bulk of the German army on the Eastern Front, was insistent that some kind of second front in Europe must happen in 1943. His idea of a second front really was a second front in France, and when eventually a second front develops in Italy, Stalin dismisses it as a sideshow. The implied threat from Stalin is that he might try to find some kind of accommodation with Hitler, leaving the Germans to once again put all their energies into the West. This meant that at Casablanca, the Americans were lobbying for a massed attack against the Germans, a cross-channel invasion of Normandy. The British were far more keen on fighting at the periphery, as they had done in the last couple of hundred years when faced with a hegemonic continental power, fighting in places such as North Africa, in Italy, perhaps even in Greece, and wearing the enemy down from the edges of their empire, perhaps engaging them in major naval actions where the British were going to be superior, and then eventually waiting for the fortunes of war to slide in the favour of the coalition, and then using the major players now, the Soviet Union and the USA, to finally launch the end game. And this is ultimately what happens. The war that emerges is very much a British war. The war that the Americans wanted to happen was a cross-channel invasion in 1943 and a head-on clash with the Wehrmacht, involving in probably casualties far, far higher than that which we actually see at D-Day. Casablanca is the last conference where the British opinion prevails. The British, under the direction of Churchill, argue against the cross-channel invasion, which probably was wise. The view of Sir Alan Brooke and Harold Alexander and other leading British generals is that the invasion would be absolute suicide, would be destined to fail, and the cost of winning would be catastrophically high. Churchill looks upon Italy, really, he calls it the soft underbelly of the Nazi Empire. It turns out, in effect, when the actual landings take place in Sicily and then later on in Salerno, that the Italian campaign wasn't going to be easy, wasn't going to be straightforward, would actually be a long and arduous experience for the Allies. The battles of Monte Cassino and the siege at Anzio are all examples of how protracted and bloody the Germans are able to make the Italian Peninsula campaign. Roosevelt, however, relents and allows the Churchill position to prevail, partly because he's more interested in this period of time at what's happening in Southeast Asia. He believes the British aren't really putting their all into fighting the Japanese, and Britain's efforts in Burma with the 14th Army, the so-called Forgotten Army, are fairly unspectacular in 1942 and 1943. And certainly in 1942, most of what happens are retreats and strategic failures. And there are some attempts in 1943, such as the Arakan campaigns, to reverse that, but they're not especially successful enterprises. So Churchill, for his part, agrees to more effort in Burma, more men, more equipment, more munitions, and really that helps to prop up Chiang Kai-shek's position in China. So the next phase of the war is up for discussion, and the issue that comes to the surface, much to the surprise of Churchill, is the doctrine of unconditional surrender. This is something that had not previously been agreed on by Churchill and Roosevelt, but Roosevelt makes a statement on it anyway, to which he says, "In our uncompromising policy, we mean no harm to the common people of the Axis nations, but we do mean to impose punishment and retribution upon their guilty, barbaric leaders." Now, these kinds of statements and sentiments really do inform the likes of Himmler and Goering and the other main perpetrators of the Holocaust. They know after Casablanca that not only will there be no negotiating, but also that there will be post-war proceedings. There will be some kind of judicial process at the end of the war because of the knowledge that is filtering out across the rest of the world of the crimes that are being committed in the East. It's only later in 1943 that concrete evidence is transmitted to America and Britain of the actual final solution. But there is widespread knowledge that if gassings aren't taking place, which obviously they were, that there is some kind of processed mass killing in the eastern part of the Nazi Empire. Churchill had misgivings about this approach. He felt obliged to go along with it, as I mentioned earlier, seeing himself as his lieutenant figure. He believed that it left the Allies with less room for manoeuvre, but that he had to be seen to support it at all costs. His chief interest was to keep the Soviet Union in the war. He knew that the Red Army, in essence, was the key to winning the war, and any negotiated peace between Stalin and Hitler would be a catastrophe for Western Europe and for Britain and America. The other consideration that Churchill had was that the Soviet Union, once they overcame the Wehrmacht, would march eastward inexorably. And where the advance of the Soviet Union ended was a key issue. Winston Churchill was quite prescient in his understanding of Stalin's interests in Eastern Europe, though later on at other conferences he makes some sort of quite amateurish mistakes with Stalin. That's a different story. His suspicion was that the Red Army, where it stopped, would stay, and so an invasion further to the east, such as in Italy, for example, would prevent the Red Army from advancing farther west. Stalin was keen for an invasion, for an Allied invasion to happen in France, because it would draw away German forces, but it wouldn't place the Allies deep in the heart of Central Europe. The victorious Allied army marching northwards from Italy could quite easily find itself in Austria, and from there into the heart of Central Europe, which would obviously later become the buffer zone for the Soviet Union. Keeping the Allies away from here was key, and Stalin was no fool. He could see what Churchill was thinking at Casablanca. Stalin himself can't attend Casablanca. He believed that he was better suited to staying in Russia and focusing on the German threat. Though that said, that when he does organise conferences at Tehran and at Yalta, Stalin likes to have things on his own terms and prefers to meet Roosevelt and Churchill essentially on his turf. The next two major conferences of 1943 at Cairo and Tehran see a gradual diminution of British influence and power. The Casablanca conference really is the high point of British influence during the war, and never again do the British regain that level of importance in the superpower stakes. By the Yalta conference, the big three has been reduced in Churchill's eyes to the big two and a half. The Italian campaign proceeds from the decisions taken at Casablanca. So this is one of the main outcomes of Casablanca, its significance, if you will. The decision to go for the soft underbelly, which turns out to be anything but. And following that, the main secondary outcome of the Casablanca conference is that of the decision for unconditional surrender, and the resolve that that really brings to the Nazis, even if they had been considering otherwise, to fight on to the end. Anyway, I hope you found that useful, and you can find more information at www.explaininghistory.com. We've got some interesting titles out at the moment. We've got Julia Routledge's hit biography of George Orwell. If you haven't downloaded that already, it's well worth a read. And there is Chris Kostov's The Communist Century. Again, you can find all these at explaininghistory.com or follow the links below. And we're going to be doing some latest, more stuff in the next few days on the Second World War conferences. So if this is a key area for you, feel free to write in, and it's great to get feedback from people out there and from listeners, students and enthusiasts. So you can get me at info@explaininghistory.com. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.